This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour. This is Richard Palmer hosting you for today. And as usual, I'm joined by our regular panel of news commentators, usually with me in the studio, but this time joining us from the frozen Arctic wasteland that is Canada. We have Mihailo Zekic, probably warmer than it is here in the UK, actually. And then at our headquarters campus in Eglinton, Oklahoma, that I'm sure is much, much warmer than us here in the UK, we have Andrew Miller and Jeremiah Jacques. Now, a lot of the news this week is all about elections. The biggest question, I think, on the minds of world leaders, not just in the United States, but around the world, is will Joe Biden step down as president of the United States? We're going to talk about that shortly with Andrew. We're going to talk about election results in France, a result that really shocked the world, reverberated around Europe. And we'll talk about as well election result in Iran. But first, we'll get the rundown of Middle Eastern news from Mihailo.
Yeah, so Hamas is starting to send in equipment to Baghdad to establish a base of operations in Iraq. This is according to the Institute for the Study of War, a think tank. Their political leadership has been based in Qatar to this point, but Qatar has been getting a bit fed up, I think, with some of the bad press hosting Hamas has given them. So there's been a few reports circulating that they are planning on moving to Iraq. And according to this latest one, they've already started moving their equipment in there, although we don't know the details as of yet. We've spoken on this program before about how Iraq is going to fall to Iran. This is a prediction we've been making all the way back to when Saddam Hussein was in the country. The fact that this kind of thing could happen from a country that nominally is a U.S. ally, that has U.S. troops on the ground right now, shows just how much that has taken place. Also related to the Israel-Hamas war, the Israeli Defense Forces have released yesterday the first report analyzing what happened on October 7th, why the military responded the way that they did. It's a minor report specifically focusing on Kibbutz Be'eri, which was a small community, one of the more notorious ones that was unfortunately had its people slaughtered during October 7th. Some of our listeners may have seen the photos of like bloodstained children's bedrooms and that kind of thing. That's from that kibbutz. And the military's excuse basically was that they weren't prepared for an assault on this kind of scale. They didn't have any plans and that sort of thing. This is the first trickle of reports we're expecting. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant has called on the government to publish a comprehensive report at large examining all angles. Netanyahu himself is still saying that the war should be concluded before anything like that happens. But we expect more details to surface from October 7th, what happened there, more details shedding light on why it turned out as catastrophic as it did.
I think that story about the headquarters moving is just really fascinating. It hits me personally because this was one of the first big kind of fulfilled prophecies I remember watching. I just kind of remember growing up as a kid during the 90s, and I would hear on the news, I would hear about all the news throughout all the 90s, not just the early 90s with the Iraq war, throughout the whole 90s, they all talked about Iraq. Iraq was the big problem in the Middle East. Iraq was the source of all instability in the Middle East. And the Key of David program every week would be very often talking about Iran and about how Iran is going to end up the king of the South, that Iran is actually going to end up dominating Iraq. So I always think it's just a fantastic proof of Bible prophecy and worth. That's the foundation of what we're talking about to you on this show, that we're guided by the selection in all of our topics, what we characterize as important, what we bring you based on Bible prophecy. And it's great to start out on a story that just shows the reliability of that. It's not because any one of our staff kind of figured something out. It's because Bible prophecy, and we'll get into that more because we're going to talk about Iran more, exactly why in just a minute. But Bible prophecy said Iran's going to dominate the Middle East. We had that forecast based on that prophecy. We've seen that fulfilled. So normally on this show, though, we're kind of on here when we're saying, well, here's a news story that you've not heard much about, and here's why it's really important and why you absolutely have to know about it. For today's top story from the Middle East, feels a bit like we're doing the opposite. We're kind of like, well, here's a story you may have heard a lot about. Actually, it might not be quite as big of a deal as the media is telling you. So do you want to tell us about that, your main story, Mihailo?
Yes, we have a new president-elect in Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian, on the 5th of July.
Nice job on the pronunciation. I haven't mastered that one yet.
You get a knack for these after saying names in Persian and Turkish over and over again. But on July 5th, right after we finished recording this program, Iran concluded its second round of presidential elections. And lo and behold, it is the so-called moderate candidate, Pezeshkian, that won the vote. He won 16.3 million votes compared to 13.5 by his rival, hardliner Saeed Jalili. He's expected to formally take it off or enter office from the temporary government sometime later this month. A lot of people, this is a bit of an unknown for a lot of media to interpret. Now, Iran, yes, Iran has elections. How legitimate they are is basically up to the whim of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and his guardian council, which is sort of his body to vet candidates. Pezeshkian sort of slipped in as a reformer among five hardliners. A lot of people interpreted this as, okay, the Ayatollah doesn't really want a reformer, and he's just sneaking one name in there to make it give it a veneer of democratic legitimacy. And even then, I mean, voter turnout in Iran was only at about 50% of the vote. So even then, most of the Iranian public doesn't buy it. But a lot of people were expecting one of the hardliners to win the vote by hook or by crook. Khamenei himself, even without naming Pezeshkian, criticized his policies before the first vote, accusing him of wanting to kowtow to the United States with his reformist views and saying that somebody like him is not fit to run the country. Lo and behold, he won. And a lot of people are taken aback by it. Is it because perhaps the Iranian public, disillusioned with everything that's going on, decided to stick it to Khamenei, swamp the vote to the point where he couldn't rig it and maybe force his hand? It's entirely possible. Iran has had a bit of turmoil lately with, say, the hijab enforcement policies. Pezeshkian, for his part, wants to cut back on enforcing on that. He wants to not basically murdering young women for not wearing headscarves, and that resonated with a lot of people. But on the other hand, even if he doesn't see eye to eye with the Ayatollah on a lot of things, there are a lot of interesting things about this guy that make you wonder if maybe he is the actual man the Ayatollah wanted in with the job. The main factor in with this, of course, is the United States elections coming up. During the presidential debates with the other five candidates, a lot of people have noticed that one name that seems to keep coming up over and over again is Donald Trump. Like, how, which candidate is going to be the best candidate to stand up to Donald Trump, even though he hasn't even officially accepted the Republican nominee yet? Nobody was talking about Joe Biden. It seems like the Iranians know for sure Trump is coming back. And if our listeners would remember way back when Trump was in office, when he was dealing with the Iranian regime, he wasn't too good to the Iranians. He canceled the nuclear deal. He assassinated Qasem Soleimani. This could be Khamenei's way of preparing Iran for a return to Trump, putting in a more moderate face compared to the previous president, Ebrahim Raisi, who, of course, died in the helicopter crash, putting someone in there that looks a bit more palatable for Trump to work with. And the reason this is also interesting is because Pezeshkian's had a few interesting endorsements for his campaign. Most high profile is Mohammad Javad Zarif, the former foreign minister that helped craft the original Obama nuclear deal. He campaigned with Pezeshkian. He even appeared on a televised forum that Pezeshkian held, answering questions for him. And then rumors are circulating, hasn't been confirmed yet, that Pezeshkian is going to nominate Abbas Araghchi as foreign minister. He was Zarif's deputy. He was the main architect of the 2015 nuclear deal. And now he's basically being given the top job. A lot of people are wondering if this is Iran's way of signaling we want a new nuclear deal, as supposedly they've been negotiating this whole time, even though the U.S. won't admit it. But if Iran is getting it ready this way, whether for Trump or if somehow Biden manages to stay in or some other candidate from the Democratic Party, it looks like Iran is sending signals that they want more nuclear negotiations, and they're putting in a face that isn't as hardliner as some of the other ones that might be a bit more palatable for the West to negotiate with.
And I think that's the history that is critical to remember here. Like, just watching all of the mainstream media talking about this guy, it was a bit of deja vu, because we had Rafsanjani come in for the nuclear deal, and he was a supposed moderate. And the Obama administration at the time put out this whole narrative of, like, we're seizing on this opportunity. We're doing this nuclear deal because suddenly we've got a moderate regime in Iran. That's why we can do this nuclear deal. They used that to sell it to the American public. Then several years later, you had Ben Rhodes, this novelist turned speechwriter, giving an interview to the New York Times, where he said, yeah, we made it all up. You know, this was the narrative. This was the fiction that we concocted, that before, we were planning this before Rafsanjani came in. Iran basically selected, you know, everybody gets vetted. Nobody gets to run for president without the approval of Khamenei. We seized on that opportunity as a way of selling the Iran deal to the American public and getting Congress to approve it and those necessary approvals. But that's not really at all what was going on here. And I think when you see the media doing the same thing again, it certainly, yeah, it's like, yeah, it's window dressing. They're playing the same trick that they played back in 2016 so that they can sell another Iranian nuke deal potentially to the American public. And I think you look at even things like turnout. Like, the Iranian public certainly didn't think that this election really was a major opportunity for them to have a big change in their country, because it was the lowest turnout on record.
The most powerful person in Iran is not the president. That is the supreme leader, who remains a bag of snakes and basically is responsible for all the things that you think of when you think of Iran, the clerical theocracy, the oppression of minorities and women and the youth, the general seeding of militant groups throughout the Middle East. None of that has changed. And now the new guy is not challenging much of that at all, especially in foreign policy. Pezeshkian has come out and said that he still supports Iran having the nuclear program. He still supports a hard line in negotiations with the West. He still supports the Houthis in their on-again, off-again conflict with Israel. He still supports Hamas against Israel. He still supports militancy throughout the region. But he's doing it with a much different tone that suggests there might be a little bit room for compromise here or there. I mean, don't count any chickens until this actually happens, but there's at least a change in mood.
That was geopolitical analyst Peter Zeihan commenting on Pezeshkian's election. And like you said, nothing's changing with Iran. He even himself, Pezeshkian, when he was talking about foreign policy, he says he wants a rapprochement with the West. But he says, I want friendly relations with every country but Israel. I mean, what is that supposed to mean? But the difference is you have somebody in there that looks, the cosmetics make him a bit more palatable for people like you were talking about, who may want to do a deal with him. And I won't even discount Trump potentially doing a deal with him as well. He talked about on a podcast this year that he was ready to do a deal with Iran before Biden came in and caused a few problems, and especially with the idea of America first withdrawing from the world. Somebody that sounds like he's supporting women's rights and supporting like a global community kind of thing might be a more palatable person to negotiate with. But regardless of whatever happens, Iran is still Iran. The radical theocracy is still the radical theocracy. Khamenei, until he dies, is most likely not going anywhere. And you're going to see Iran keep doing what it's doing, with or without the U.S. getting in the way.
So we're not expecting a big change in Iran. And part of that is absolutely informed by people like Peter Zeihan, an understanding of events on the ground, and, you know, an understanding of the radical left in the United States and everything that we've been watching for all these years. But this is also a forecast that we're making backed by Bible prophecy, isn't it, Mihailo?
Of course. And it actually ties in with that prophecy you were talking about earlier about Iraq. That's in Daniel 11, verse 40. It speaks about a king of the south and a king of the north clashing. The rest of the prophecy continues into the next chapter to a crisis so bad there would be nothing like it in history. This is talking about World War III. And since the 1990s, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has identified radical Islam as led by Iran as being this king of the south pushing against the king of the north, which is Catholic Europe. So because of that, we expect Iran to keep growing and growing and growing in power. A lot of things that you've seen over the past half a year or so, October 7th, the Houthi attack. Those are pretty big pushes and provocations against the West, including against Europe. But we haven't seen Iran reach, I guess, what we would call the Daniel 1140 apex of power just yet. We expect Iran to keep getting stronger, to keep getting pushier, to keep adding more countries to its proxy empire, which means it's not going to slow down. The leadership is not going to slow it down. The outside world is not going to slow it down. And who knows, maybe with somebody that has a more moderate face under the Ayatollah running the ship, perhaps people could feel like, okay, we can put the brakes on a little bit. We can, Iran's getting a bit more normal. We can let them do what they're doing. Our Mr. Fleury has also pointed out, you look at Daniel 11 and there's no reference to the U.S. By this point, the U.S. is out of the picture. How exactly this will all play in, we don't know. But one thing's for certain, Iran's not moderating. Pezeshkian is not Iran's Gorbachev. We're not seeing the fall of Iran's Iron Curtain just yet. We're going to see Iran double down on its trajectory. And who knows, Pezeshkian, despite his appearance, may be the man under the Ayatollah to push the accelerator. If our listeners would like to learn more, I highly recommend our editor-in-chief's free book, The King of the South. It's available on thetrumpet.com. That's The King of the South.
And that is a great book to really start to get to grips with understanding Bible prophecy. You know, if your curiosity has been piqued by what you've heard so far, that's a really good foundational book. It's kind of written to be as welcoming as possible. If you don't know anything about Bible prophecy, to help you dig into it, the United States and Britain in Prophecy is kind of probably the most foundational that is really going to help unlock your understanding the most. But The Key of the King of the South is also just a great foundational book for understanding what the Bible has to say about this important piece of world news, but about so much else as well. And it's really a powerful tool for understanding the Middle East, but also just for understanding God's plan in end time events, that there is a God, that Jesus Christ himself referred to prophecies in the book of Daniel, and that if you want to understand what God is doing on this earth and even God's plan for mankind, you need to understand Bible prophecy, because all of Bible prophecy revolves around that plan for mankind. So that's our free book, The King of the South. We'll mention, as usual, different pieces of free literature on this show as we go through. You can go to our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read it there. You can download it there. You can order a free print copy there. We make that available as well because we think this is just so valuable. We want you to be able to have your own copy that you can study in front of you and even scribble in the margins if you like to go through your books like that and just digest it as thoroughly as possible. So that's up on our website, thetrumpet.com. Click on the literature tab and you can find all of those pieces. Well, I thought it was interesting. You mentioned Gorbachev there at the end, Mihailo. He's not the Soviet president that I've been hearing the most about this week. Instead, that's probably Brezhnev, where now people are making all these comparisons between the US leadership and some of the later Soviet leaders and the way that the Soviet press kind of covered up massive health problems and things like that. So we'll move now towards the United States, where really the mental capacity of its leader has been the overarching dominant story. But Andrew, if you could give us a rundown of what we need to know from the United States this week.
Yeah, it has been a crazy week in the United States. We have a new reports out that the U.S. military is actually hiding its push to fund transgender surgeries for both soldiers and their children. Shockingly, 198 Democrats voted against a bill that would require documentary proof of citizen to register to vote. So this is most of the Democrats in Congress trying to make sure that you don't actually have to be a citizen to vote for the president this November. And the House Oversight Committee has taken some long-needed action, subpoenaed three top White House aides, and is questioning about them about who they report to and who their supervisor reports to, an attempt to track down who's actually running the United States of America. It's become a more public knowledge since Joe Biden's disastrous debate that he's probably not the one making the calls in the White House. His staff, they seem to be on autopilot, so there's now an actual and official investigation to track down who's taking orders. I kind of expect Epicenter will start congealing about 3 miles from the White House at Obama's $8 million mansion, but we'll keep a close eye at that story.
Now, your main story, I guess, is a bit of an intersection between the United States and Europe. And it's this major NATO summit that took place in Washington this week, right?
Yes. Yeah, this is actually significant for both international and domestic reasons here in America, because it's an understatement to say that America's NATO allies are unnerved at the prospect of a senile president, a president commanding the most powerful military alliance in world history. And then domestically, a lot of Democrats were hoping this NATO summit would be Biden's chance to prove that he was just jet lagged and had a bad night on debate night, kind of his chance to come back and salvage what's left of his campaign. He did do better than he did in the debate. It would be hard to do worse, although it wasn't a great night for him. He introduced Ukrainian President Zelensky to the podium for his speech, saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, Vladimir Putin," who is Zelensky's main enemy. He also reassured his audience that he would not have appointed Donald Trump as his vice president if she didn't have confidence she could do the job. You can definitely tell that Zelensky, Putin, Harris, and Trump are on the top of his mind right now. He's just kind of getting them confused as to there's two people in Ukraine and there's two people who want my job. So that probably didn't go as far as he wanted towards reassuring America's NATO allies that their future's in good hands. One person at the press conference asked him the very salient question that must be on everyone's minds: what do you like most about Kamala Harris, and why do you think that she'd be a good president? Because if Biden drops out of the race, or even if he gets into office and has to resign, Harris would be next up to bat. And he actually went on and on about how he really think what she's done for women's bodies and the fight for abortion is the main reason he'd think she'd be a good president, which again, I'm sure a lot of those NATO leaders are pro-abortion, but I don't think that's the answer they were looking for at the top of their mind. Like, oh, well, Harris is pro-abortion. He's like, that's well and good in their eyes, I suppose. But it's like, can she defend Eastern Europe from a Russian invasion? I think we've pointed out on this program a number of times before that the very first Secretary General of NATO summed up the purpose of that alliance very well when he said the NATO alliance was designed to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. So if the Russians are coming in, then Germany is going to go up unless you can actually get some strong American leadership in the region. And I think that's what the NATO allies are mainly looking for. Like, are we in good hands, or do we have to make other arrangements? Because Russia is a problem, and if the president of the United States is suffering from dementia, we may need to rethink that equation and actually have the Germans go up and the Americans go out and maybe even pull the Russians in a little bit with some sort of deal.
I mean, you mentioned the European leaders being unnerved. I saw one video this morning circulating where somebody'd found some footage of Ursula von der Leyen at the meeting where I think this was a portion of the meeting where Mr. Biden showed up. He left after 20 minutes and she was rolling her eyes, pretending to look at her watch. She didn't actually have a watch on. I don't think you could quite hear what she was saying, but kind of she seemed quite irritated at this president that just wasn't even there physically. He left so quickly. I think that's a good point about how, well, okay, where do we turn if we don't have the United States? I mean, there's a whole lot of countries in Europe that know the only reason that they did not get squashed by the Soviet Union was the United States. In some kind of weird way, they resent the United States for that, I think. They don't like to acknowledge or be reminded of that fact. But they are, at their heart of hearts, well aware of that. And so if the United States is not there for them, and Russia is rising and Russia is invading Ukraine, and we'll hear more about some of what they've been doing this week just a little bit later on, they desperately do need some other arrangement.
Yeah, that is absolutely the case we're dealing with right now in Europe. Even Donald Trump, who's not as bad as the media makes him out to be in terms of his relationship with NATO, he's definitely to the point where he's like, he doesn't want America spending as much as they have been on wars in Ukraine. So he wants Europeans to up their military spending so that this is more of an alliance of equals. It wouldn't so much be the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down, but it would be the Americans in, the Germans up, and together trying to contain Russia, which is not a complete repudiation of that formula, but definitely a significant tweak that the Europeans have to realize that he's like, if Biden's demented and senile, then we need to be able to stand on our own 2 feet. If Trump's telling us we need to stand on our own 2 feet because he doesn't want to pull all the weight, you're coming at this from two very different angles, but you kind of get the same result at the end of the day, which is a European military power that is far more capable of dealing with Russian aggression on its own without having to worry so much like they were worrying last night. Is like, is the president of the United States have the mental capacity to defend us?
So this is something we're watching, you know, really backed by Bible prophecy once again. This is a trend. I think I can think of several different trumpet covers that kind of come to mind. I think we had one quite memorable one about 10 years ago that showed Europeans running from Russia and running to Germany. And you've had this dynamic where for a lot of European countries, they would rather trust the United States. The United States has been a relatively benign hegemon, to use the kind of the more technical terms that you see foreign policy experts discuss it in, that they've been a much lighter touch, say, for Europe coming in and defending European nations than alternatives have, than other empires have in history. But if they can't do that, well, then they're starting to look to Germany, they're starting to look to other countries. So do you want to give a bit more of that prophetic background, Andrew?
Right. Yeah, like I said, there's definitely numerous Bible prophecies you could point to in this case. I think one I wanted to highlight is we have a trends article titled Why the Trumpet Watches America's Retreat from Global Leadership. So the trumpet's obviously watching America's retreat from global leadership. All these leaders at the NATO summit are also pretty worried about America's retreat from global leadership, which has a pretty amazing prophecy. It starts out in Micah chapter 5, verses 7 through 9. That talks about the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people as a dew from the Lord, as showers on the grass, and as a lion among the nations, as a young lion among flocks of sheep. And the late Herbert W. Armstrong pointed out in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that the dew referenced in this verse is basically all the financial aid America's giving ailing nations around the world. And the lion is about the military power America's used to basically be the world's policeman. The particular prophecy, it's definitely an amazing proof that America is descended from ancient Israel in the fact that it has become a military superpower, but not a military superpower like Rome that just conquered and oppressed nations, but a military superpower that actually used its wealth to save nations from famine and used its military to protect nations from hostile dictators. But then, right in the next few verses, if you get past verse 9, it says, "And it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord, that I'll cut off the horses out of the midst of you. I will destroy your chariots. I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds." So this is actually talking about a military collapse, and not even really like a subtle one, like the Roman Empire, where they were kind of like spent 200 years in subtle decline before they collapsed. But a collapse that like just kind of as they get up to this power where they're this dew amongst the nations and this lion amongst the animals of the forest, their strongholds get cast down. So there's a pretty sudden decline from world leadership that wakes up these European nations to be like, okay, well, we actually have to form our own military superpower to defend ourselves because the lion that's been defending us isn't around anymore. He's too weak to defend anybody. So that's really why the trumpet's watching this prophecy is the part about America being the lion in the forest and the dew in the nations, that's already been fulfilled. But the part about the military power being cast down, you can see rumblings that it's about to happen, but it hasn't been fulfilled yet. And that's definitely the question. Like I said, I haven't seen that video yet. I will go look at it, but I'm sure if you look at Ursula von der Leyen's face, she's not thinking about Micah 5, but she's definitely worried about, is the world's policeman going to keep on policing, or do we need a new world's policeman?
It was Giorgia Meloni. I'm sorry if I said von der Leyen. Sometimes I get these European leaders mixed up. But that trends article, you can get that on our website. That's at the top right-hand corner. There's a trends tab. But a lot of the smaller stories from Europe also revolve. I mean, they kind of relate to this NATO summit, but this Europe having to look for itself. Poland announced this week to coincide with that NATO summit that they were going to be boosting their defense spending to the highest levels in their history. And another big thing to come from that NATO summit was the United States announcing that it would be sending long-range missiles to Germany. This has kicked off a pretty big debate within Germany, where there's a lot of people that don't want long-range US missiles. It's kind of a big deal. They've not been there, I don't think, since the 1990s. Russia has said that they're going to retaliate. But it certainly does up the pressure on Germany to be more independent, to be making these... it's happening with the approval of the US government, but to have these kind of things themselves and to be able to protect themselves. But the main story, the big story that I wanted to talk about from Europe is once again another election. I think it's pretty funny that the United States is spent... You know, one of the big things with Joe Biden is they're trying to decide, well, is it too soon or is it too late for us to get rid of Joe Biden as Democratic candidate? The elections are only a few months away. France had an election in like a month. It's done, it's dusted. They announced it, I think, at the start of June, and we saw that conclude on Sunday. The upshot of that, though, is they have no idea how they're going to put together a functioning government. They have had... there was some initial rejoicing after that election, and now they're kind of, there's this looking around saying, oh no, what have we done? And all of Europe was watching this election. We talked about this last time, you might remember, on last week's show, where France has this two-round system where if a candidate gets more than 50% of the vote in the first round of the election, they get the seat, they're in parliament, they're done, they're good, it's over. Most of the time that doesn't happen. And in that case, if no candidate gets more than 50%, everybody that gets more than a certain minimum goes through to the second round. Second round of voting happened on Sunday. After the first round, National Rally did really well. This party that's characterized as far right, they're generally kind of painted and believed to be beyond the fringe, completely unacceptable for polite society. They won. They came in first place. They were in pole position in more of those constituencies than anybody else, looked like they were going to win the election. This time around, they, in terms of parliamentary seats, they were beaten in third place. So that was the big headline news. There was a lot of rejoicing, people saying, okay, phew, we stopped the far right, we stopped the National Rally. They did not come in first place in this election. Trouble is, they did that with some very, very tactical voting. They did still come in first place in the popular vote. In fact, their vote share increased. But the left and the right kind of worked together to block National Rally from power. The right would withdraw their candidate if the left was best focused to win, and vice versa. And what they're waking up to is the realization that this has actually enabled quite a radically left-wing power to come in first place. So France, they'll often, you have a lot of smaller parties, and then they'll get together and form these alliances for the election. So the winner that won the most seats in the French parliament is the New Popular Front. And the biggest party within this New Popular Front is, what is it, like La France Insoumise, something like that. It means France unbowed, France undefeated. And that leader is Jean-Luc Mélenchon. And he's a pretty radical guy. Like, he wants a 90% tax rate on all income over 400,000 euros. That's actually a climb down. In a previous manifesto, he's called for 100% tax rate there. Government just takes all of your money. If you're rich, you don't need that. Government takes it and redistributes it. He wants France out of NATO, even France out of the EU. EU's too right-wing for him. He would make France overwhelmingly the most socialist, the most communist major economy on earth today. Not quite a French Cuba, but that is the kind of direction that he wants to take France in. It's a massive amount of spending. He wants to lower the pension age, do all of these kind of things. He is also pretty radical when it comes to foreign policy. He wants to recognize Palestine as an independent state. He wants to welcome migrants in. France migration formed a major part of this debate, and he was generally the most migrant friendly of all of the leaders there. And he and his alliance gets a lot of support from the strong Muslim minority that is there in France. So he has won that election. People looking at that and starting to realize, okay, we could be in a pretty terrible position now. France's debt is already really big. And I mentioned a few weeks ago, Andrew had an article a few weeks ahead of the election pointing out how worried financial markets were because National Rally might win and they wanted to lower pension ages and things. What Mélenchon wants to do is way more dramatic in terms of lowering pension age, spending money than anything National Rally talked about. And he has won the election. He leads at least the biggest party within this left-wing bloc. So the outgoing finance minister, he says that his policies are exorbitant and would destroy everything we've achieved over the last 7 years. He said the immediate risk is a financial crisis. European Central Bank has already put France in this excess deficit procedure, this kind of, you know, the naughty step for countries that have borrowed too much money. And if you think about how much, like we're living, Europe is still living in the shadow of the Greek financial crisis. That changed everything for Europe. The very fact even that the National Rally was doing so well is in large part due to this new world that Europe is living in after the Greek financial crisis. France's economy is 13 times larger than Greece. Greece is just a little rainstorm compared to the tornado that would be unleashed on Europe if you had a French debt crisis. So you've got this as a real potential problem for Europe and particularly for Germany, the economic heart and core of Europe that really relies on sound money and has been much more wise and careful with its money than a lot of the rest of the European countries and relies on its exports and things like that. Potential for a massive crisis for Germany if France goes bankrupt because they're going to get dragged under by that. But Mélenchon has a solution for if France triggers a debt crisis. That solution is basically steal money from Germany. He had a book. I love the title to this book. It came out about 10 years ago. It's called Bismarck's Herring. In that book, he wrote, "The German Empire is back." He said, "She has become a danger to her neighbors and her partners. I denounce her arrogance and so-called model imposed for her profits alone. A monster is born across the Rhine." And to his credit, I mean, Mélenchon saw the way that the financial crisis enabled, empowered, raised up Germany to be the leader of Europe in a way that nobody in Europe voted for. So yeah, you know, he's right in diagnosing the German Empire is back, and Germany was, through that financial crisis, absolutely dominating countries like Greece and Cyprus and others. And Mélenchon sees that if this process continues, Germany will be dominating France. So yeah, he diagnoses the problem. His solution is to basically for France to stick it to Germany by putting a gun to Germany's head, like saying, give us 100 billion euros or we're opening up the printing presses and we're printing our own euros, which is basically stealing money from German savers. So you've got the potential for a real crisis for Germany, the potential just for a euro crisis on its own. That's a big crisis for Germany. You throw in the fact that you have a leader now that kind of won this election that wants to use a financial crisis to actively go out there and harm and attack Germany. That raises things to another level. There's also a critical opportunity for Germany here, though, because Mélenchon, you know, his bloc won the largest number of seats. His bloc is going to be influential on the next German government. There's also no way Mélenchon is going to be the next prime minister. I mean, he's demanding it. It's not going to happen. The arithmetic, the maths just doesn't work out. And actually, it's hard to see who can form any kind of functioning government in France. Politico, they just said, governing France will be hellish now. The Spectator, they wrote, France will probably be ungovernable for some time to come. They wrote, France is now confronted by paralysis and institutional crisis. France has had 16 constitutions since 1789. Jean-Luc Mélenchon and La France Insoumise have been calling for a sixth republic for years. That may now be approached. It might be so bad that France needs a new constitution. That's how much gridlock we might be in for. So you've got this situation where, okay, there's the potential to really hurt Germany, but France is pretty rudderless and leaderless. Now Emmanuel Macron is still the president, and the president under France's constitution has a lot of power. But Macron, he's worked with Germany before. He might well be willing to work with Germany to cement his hold over France while the government and the parliament is horribly divided. So you've got this situation that gives Germany both a very strong incentive to step up, to take more control of Europe before France uses this common currency to really hurt them. And they've also got an opportunity to do that. And this is what we've been saying right from the start of the financial crisis. This is all the way from, I think, either late 2008, early 2009, from Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry. He wrote, the crisis in Greece is a forerunner of a whole rash of similar crises set to soon break out across Europe. They will provide the catalyst for the EU's leading nation, Germany, to rise to the fore with solutions of its own making. Biblical prophecy declares that the result will be a European superstate with Germany at the helm. And that is not good news for America, Britain, and the little nation called Israel. And we did see how the European financial crisis was then this catalyst that caused rolling other crises coming along afterwards that gave more and more power to Germany. Being part of this common currency, being part of the euro, ties Germany's fate to all of these other countries. And when these countries get into trouble, it causes Germany financial pain. It affects German taxpayers. And now Germany's got the opportunity and the incentive to establish control over all of Europe's spending before France goes in and crashes themselves into the wall and needs a fix from Germany. And now Germany's current government, they might not be far-sighted enough to seize that opportunity, but the euro was created to provide this mechanism to constantly push European countries towards being a super state that voters have never wanted. Sell them on the euro, much easier than selling them on a combined super state. It ties their economies together in this way. And so it's leading to this biblically prophesied change. Mr. Flurry made those forecasts back in 2008 because of Bible prophecy, because Revelation 17 describes this beast or empire led by a woman or a church in biblical symbolism that rises and falls. And only Europe has hosted an empire that's been heavily influenced and led by a church that rises and falls. And the last, this modern incarnation of this empire, as the Bible says, it's going to have one mind. It's going to give its strength and power to this beast, to this empire. It's going to combine forces. And that is what France is going to do. They're going to give their strength and their power to Germany. And that's one thing that you will see emerge from this. This is something that Mr. Flurry has really pointed to just even recently, that France is going to enable this European empire. And I think you could see this election and the turmoil in France playing a key role, and maybe even Emmanuel Macron further enabling and empowering Germany so that his control remains in France. And Mr. Flurry wrote about that in great detail in a very recent article. I think it was the main June Trumpet print edition. It was the cover article for there, France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany. If you want to hear more on that story, that article is going to tell you all about the Franco-German relationship and how your Bible tells us about that. Well, that's the big news from Europe. That leaves us one more major region to talk about, and that is Asia. Jeremiah, can you give us the rundown of the week's events from Asia?
Sure, yes. First of all, Russia carried out its biggest missile attack in months on Ukraine. This was on Monday. And the Russians fired 38 missiles, including highly advanced hypersonic missiles, and it fired them all at civilian targets in five different Ukrainian cities. And one of those targets was a children's hospital, the largest children's hospital in Ukraine. Altogether, these strikes killed 42 people, including five children. And then the number of wounded is well north of 100. And these were all civilians. You know, none of these targets were military in nature. Ukraine is not Hamas hiding their soldiers and weapons inside hospitals and whatnot. And Russia knows this and knew that it was killing civilians. So it is a good reminder of how wicked this war is that Russia's waging. Last year, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory wrote about that. He said, quote, "Russia's war is giving the world a vivid picture of the scale of evil Vladimir Putin is willing to commit. Putin is an evil, ruthless, vindictive agent. He has disgusting and even devastating policies that are sick to the core and even satanic," end quote. So a powerful quote there to keep in mind, I think, if you hear someone kind of lionizing Russia in this war. Next up is a somewhat related story. The same day that this unconscionable Russian attack happened on the children's hospital and those other civilian targets, that same day, several hours later, the prime minister of India, which is supposed to be a democracy, arrived in Moscow. And Prime Minister Modi didn't just meet with Putin, the architect of the war and of those civilian strikes, but Modi actually gave Putin a big warm hug. Modi embraced this war criminal while all the world was watching. So that was the leader of the Indian people, the most populous country on earth, showing the world that Russia's war has not isolated the Russians. He was showing that if anything, it has brought Russia and India closer. And it was just a very disturbing scene to witness. And then one other quick story here about Japan and the Philippines. These two countries are terrified of China's increasing belligerence and bullying, and they want to be ready to stand up and defend themselves against it. So on Tuesday, the two of them signed a landmark defense agreement. This agreement will allow Japan to deploy significant numbers of forces to the Philippines for joint military drills, and it sets the stage for an official mutual defense treaty to be signed between these two nations. These two nations that hated each other a great deal not long ago because of Japan's invasion and occupation of the Philippines in World War II. So it shows you just how quickly circumstances can change in international relations, how fast the battle lines can be redrawn. And it shows that more and more Asian countries are taking very significant steps to ally themselves together.
I think your main story relates to that as well. I teach an international relations class here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, and I test people on the news. Sometimes I try to catch the students out a little bit. One of the questions I have to catch them out is a true or false: China moved troops to its borders with Ukraine this week, which, of course, China doesn't have a border with Ukraine. It catches a surprising number of students out, though. But they kind of did move troops to the border of Ukraine this week, nonetheless, didn't they?
They did, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a part of what I wanted to discuss for the big story. And that is just that China is a decisive enabler of Russia's war on Ukraine. That is according to a declaration that NATO leaders published on Wednesday. And that was their exact wording. China is a decisive enabler of Russia's war on Ukraine. This is by far the most serious rebuke against China that NATO has issued. But if you look at the facts of everything that China has been giving to Russia, it's plain to see that that is accurate. China has been buying huge quantities of Russian oil and gas, which keeps the Russian economy afloat. And then more specific to the war, China has been providing Russia with satellite imagery for military use. China has been selling Russia large quantities of militarily useful semiconductors, ball bearings, trucks, excavators, even machine tools for tanks. And as we spoke about last week, China is also selling Russia attack drones and even working on a plan to develop these drones as kind of a joint venture with Russian companies. So these are major assists, potentially game-changing assists, you could say, for Russia's war. And then on top of all that, China has also held joint military exercises with Russia multiple times since the full-scale war started. And then just this week, China also held joint war games with Belarus, which is essentially an extension of Russia. Russia is kind of a puppet state. So I think that's, what you're talking about there. China had troops in Belarus right on the border with Ukraine. So it's sort of not technically China's border, but with Russia and China allied as closely as they are, you can see how the situation there is just a really interesting one. And this pattern is clear. The evidence is undeniable. This NATO statement, it is accurate. And I think it's great that they issued this statement. But even though this is the toughest rebuke by NATO of China's wicked support for a wicked war, it's still only a statement. You know, it's toothless and it's unlikely to do anything except maybe push China even deeper into the Russian camp. So I think it's commendable, I guess, that NATO leaders are calling China out more directly. But if these same nations had immediately taken concrete action at the first sign of China's enablement, even if that action was only applying some rigid sanctions on China, then I think that there's a good chance that this war would have already ended by now.
And that's another of these forecasts that have been so specific and direct and longstanding from that we based on Bible prophecy that we're seeing play out in our headline news. I was just looking through some of that, writing the morning brief today, where it was about 10 years ago, we had an article, Mr. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article, Asia Stands with Putin, on the way that all of Asia was rallying around him back when he initially started invading Ukraine. Then there was a kind of a follow-up to that just 2 or 3 years ago called Asia Still Stands with Putin, where there were all of these very specific forecasts, again, based on Bible prophecy that said, oh, the West is trying to isolate Russia. That's not going to succeed. And actually, the Ukraine war is going to bring all of these countries in much more closely aligned with Russia than they were before the war. And you know, the stories that you've been talking about today, both in your kind of rundown at the start and your main story, I mean, they really show that the forecast was exactly spot on. So can you tell us a bit of the prophecy behind that forecast?
Sure, yeah. Really, the trumpet keeps a very close watch on the strength and cooperation, not just between Russia and China, but on other Asian nations as well. And that is because it's something that Bible prophecy warned us about. We have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy. It takes a close look at these warnings that are in the books of Ezekiel and Daniel, also Joel and Matthew and Revelation and some others. And together, these show that Russia and China will soon be allied together with several other Asian nations. And these passages show that this large Asian bloc will play one of the central roles in the next world war. So when we see China becoming Russia's decisive enabler for this war, and when we see some of those other stories I mentioned, India's prime minister giving Putin a big bear hug, and Japan and the Philippines signing a defense pact. You know, right now, some of that is due to tensions among Asian nations and specifically fear of China. But even though that's the case right now, these various partnerships that are growing stronger are still laying the groundwork for the whole region to join forces once they're faced with a bigger threat. And that's something that this booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, explains very thoroughly. So I think that this booklet could be really illuminating for any listeners who would like to understand current events in Asia in that context.
And just like the King of the South, this Russia and China in Prophecy, fantastic foundational booklet for understanding world events, for understanding Bible prophecy, for understanding how really the events that you're seeing in the world today revolve all around the gospel. They revolve around God's plan for mankind. And as we see all of, you know, we see children's hospitals destroyed and a great many unpleasant stories, understanding how that these news events revolve around what God is doing to bring all mankind into his family. That is the real source of hope that you need. So that booklet and all these others, like I said, you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. It's been great to have you with us. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or questions, as I mentioned before, last time I was doing this, we are looking at making some changes. So if you've got suggestions, now's the time to get in touch. You can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I'd like to thank Isaac Lorenz, Parker Campbell, and George Haddad for engineering and production. We will be back next week. And until then, keep watching your world.